From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Joe Shaneman at State of Nevada. Newer technologies don't always change the economy, but disruptive technologies do. And in Las Vegas, ride-sharing apps like Uber and Lyft and short-term rental apps like Airbnb have really changed the landscape for taxi companies and, to some degree, hotels. In July of 2014, for instance, the Nevada Taxi Cab Authority said cab drivers gave more than 2 million rides to customers. But in July of this year, that was down about 50% to around 1 million rides. At the same time, there's a lawsuit by short-term rental groups against the way that ordinances are being overseen and meted out in Las Vegas and Clark County. So let's get into this. And we're going to start with Andrew Gnadovich. He's a real estate agent who has driven both taxis and for Uber. And he formerly wrote a blog, Las Vegas Cabbie Chronicles. Andrew, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So is there any question that the drop in rides for the taxi companies is a direct result of these of ride-sharing companies?
No, there's no question at all. You just read the stats. So there's, I don't know how many thousands more drivers on the road now as there was when, you know, before the advent of Uber. So there's probably at least twice as many. So you go from having 2,000 cabs on the road, give or take, at any given time to somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 if you count, you know, Uber drivers and cab drivers together. So it's obviously diluting the pool of rides.
So you were a cab driver for 15 years?
That's right.
At the height, what could you say what you made in a year?
I made a very good living, you know, driving a cab before the advent of Uber. I mean, I was able to support my family and purchase a home, and it was a very good job.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say I started it as a part-time thing. And because the money was so good, that's why I did it for so long.
Wow. And then you got out of it because the money had dropped off?
That was a big part of it. I mean, I was ready to move on for my own reasons too. Mm-hmm. But there's no question that the business had changed, especially the last handful of years I was in the business.
You know, at this time this happened, I remember when Uber came to town, I wasn't really sure what it was, didn't think it was going to really work out. This is 11 years ago now. I remember them calling me and talking to me about it. But the cab companies were also warned. I know lobbyists for the cab companies at the time, they told me that they tried to get the cab companies to create their own app. And the cab companies perhaps didn't believe it was going to be as serious as it became to be either. Do you blame the companies for not getting with this technology fast enough?
I think there's plenty of blame to be placed with the cab companies themselves. And as I understand it, the idea for an app to hail a ride actually came from a cab company. It wasn't that Uber invented it. They actually arguably commandeered that idea from someone else. But it's easy to create an app. It's not so easy to get millions and millions of people to download it and to use it. So that was really what Uber did, was make something they took an idea that pre-existed and they funded it and they advertised for it. And obviously here we are talking about it. So that's very successful. But there's no question that a lot of the behavior of the cab companies and cabbies individually opened the door for disruption.
By the way, we did reach out to several cab companies to join us today. They did not get back to us, but Uber and Lyft did give us statements. Uber said under existing law, Uber is required to carry more than twice the amount of insurance as taxis, conduct annual background checks on every driver, and pay more than $1 million in annual fees on top of the state's excise tax. Hundreds of thousands of Nevadans rely on rideshare, and we don't think we should turn the clock back to the days where reliable transportation was reserved for tourists on the Strip. And a Lyft spokesperson just left us a message saying all drivers that we have must undergo robust multi-tiered background checks, and we continuously monitor for criminal convictions and driving record violations. So you were a cab driver again for 15 years. Do you see do you see the end of cab companies? Do you think this is the way it is going to be and it's going to keep sliding? Because we just saw in July the number of cab rides in July of this year is down from cab rides of last year as well.
Sure. Well, arguably Uber is a cab company. So to say that, you know, the cab companies aren't going to be a thing anymore isn't really accurate, I think. I mean, people are always going to need a short-term solution to a ride here or there. So if that means it's a taxi, a traditional taxi, if that means someone in their own car, you know, taking you somewhere in exchange for money, that that concept, I think, is going to permeate for a very long time. So what we decide to call it is probably just semantics.
So you keep a close contact with people in the industry, in the cab industry, and you watch over it. They've instituted, or I don't know if all of the companies have, flat rates. How do you think that's impacted things?
That was an attempt to sort of combat some of the public outcry with regards to the long hauling issue, which was cabbies that were deliberately taking people the long way, and in the name of
so they could get more money.
Precisely. So particularly from the airport. They implemented a flat fee, which was a good idea and probably should have happened decades ago.
Yeah. Cab companies have expressed frustration at the lack of regulations for rideshare companies. Beyond what the Uber and Lyft have just left us messages about, where they said they have to do criminal background checks and a lot more, what else do you think is needed?
Well, quickly, with regards to the background checks, as someone who's gone through the state-regulated background check required by the Taxi Cab Authority and gone through a little website that Uber likes to trumpet as being thorough, I can tell you that the state background check that the cab companies require of drivers is significantly more robust. They even require fingerprints, for that sort of thing. So with regards to the rest of it, I think, like I said, Uber's not going anywhere, and I think – eventually, to go back to your other question, I think the traditionally family-owned cab business probably is going the way of the 8-track.
I wonder about this eventuality. If another disruptive technology could eventually end ride-sharing companies, because Google's driverless cab, Waymo, is everywhere in downtown San Francisco. I recently saw it. They drive just as fast, maybe crazily, as regular cab drivers, and there's nobody sitting behind the wheel. Tesla is moving in that direction. Amazon Zoox is testing its driverless taxi in Las Vegas. Do you think this is the next evolution in transportation, and could it disrupt Uber and Lyft?
There's no question. I think Uber's days are numbered also, and I think the real thing is going to be the auto manufacturers, like you mentioned Tesla. They've already said they're going to have their own app, and what do they need Uber for? They make the cars. They can keep the whole pie for themselves, and I think you'll see GM and companies like Ford do the same exact thing. Uber has spent billions of dollars to change consumer behavior, and what prevents GM from saying, thanks, guys, we'll take it from here.
Yeah, very interesting. I want to bring in now Mark Tremblay. He's a UNLV professor of economics with a particular focus on the digital economy, apps, and how they impact the economy. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So rideshare services like Uber and Lyft have been good for Nevada, for Las Vegas? I mean, what's your opinion?
Definitely good for some, right? I mean, I'm an economist, so I'm always going to say there's a trade-off, but I think obviously on the consumer side, the market became more competitive, right? So there's no question this is good for consumers. There's no question this is good for tourists. Tourists generate a lot of revenue in other ways. But I also think something that's often overlooked is there are things that complement people, their purchasing behavior beyond Uber and Lyft, right? So if it's easy to go to a restaurant, I'm more likely to go to a restaurant. And Uber and Lyft have provided that for a lot of locals.
Are rideshare companies more profitable than a regular taxi company?
So that I'm not sure of, but it's so hard to know because Uber and Lyft have invested so much in just gaining market share, right? So they've had prices, I think, low. They've given discounts to new consumers, and that's made it a little tricky to understand. But in terms of revenue, I mean, it's overwhelmingly in their favor relative to traditional taxis.
And we do have a call here. Derek from Las Vegas says he's an Uber driver. He wants to comment. Derek, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm an Uber driver, and I want to say I feel like the taxi drivers want a ambulance, but the simple fact of the matter is they should have changed their business model a long time ago. Customers that I have always complain to me about when they take taxis, how they're dirty, how the people are rude, etc. But I want to point out something to what the economist is saying and what the guy said about GM, etc. Uber has now instituted a program where they rent Teslas to drivers. So you have a lot of people coming into the country. They need a leg up. They do that. But what happens is because they owe $500 a week on that car, they take every single ride out there, which means Uber can lower the price of each ride to like $4. At that point, the people who have cars are getting phased out. So I think it's all part of a plan to phase the drivers like me who have a car out, keep the drivers who have the Teslas until they have the self-driving cars. It's just capitalism eating itself, because once nobody has a job, who's going to be able to afford an Uber?
Wow. Great call. Thank you so much, Derek, for that. I really appreciate it. And again, I'm back here with Mark Tremblay. He's a professor of economics at UNLV. And Mark, I asked about driverless taxis earlier. When you see them in San Francisco, they drive just as fast, just as cannily as human drivers. So do you think that is the next evolution of transportation? And do you think, as I asked Andrew, that it could be that it could disrupt ride shares apps like Uber and Lyft?
Yeah, I think that's a question of when, not if, right? So it's just a matter of when is the technology going to be good enough and consumers, I think, as well to be comfortable enough, right? I mean, this is part of the problem with Uber and Lyft gaining some share from people who are a bit older and less used to the technology. It's going to be the same hurdle there with driverless cars, I think.
You know, Derek, who just called, had said he believes prices are going to go down or cost to take an Uber are going to go down. But in July, the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs said Uber prices had risen 83% between 2018 and 2022. Do you know what's going on there? What's behind that? Is it that Uber are seeing unexpected costs? What do you think is going on there?
So it could be a cost story, but I also think, you know, early on, Uber wanted to attract a lot of drivers and a lot of riders. And so when they enter into a city, they keep their margins low. And I think that lasted for a long time, right? You can't just abruptly increase prices very quickly. So I think they've done it slowly, but it's really picked up more recently, right? And I think, I don't know if that trend will necessarily continue because if you raise the prices too high, someone else can come up with, you know, Uber too,
right,
and attract drivers and riders at lower prices. So we'll see what the equilibrium looks like in the end, but right now it does feel like we're not at the final point.
So interesting. You know, taxis have been around more than 100 years in this country. They're tried and true. They did get some bad press here 10 years or more for what Andrew talked about, long hauling. There were stories about, you know, sort of the rudeness or people unable in the neighborhoods to get a taxi to come and actually pick them up. I experienced that myself. Because it's easier to go from the airport to the strip, back many more trips, much more money. At the same time, we hear bad things about Uber and Lyft, you know, about some of the drivers. Maybe they commit, you know, criminal acts with some of their passengers. I wonder if you ever think taxis are going to be able to make a comeback, seeing as how you study this industry, apps and technology.
So I see them now as just carving out different parts of the market, right, where traditional taxis are always going to be better from this centralized perspective. If I go to the airport or if I'm coming home from the airport, it sucks picking up an Uber and Lyft. You have to coordinate with your phone. There's 100 other people in the parking garage doing the same. Taxi line, you walk right to the front.
Is that the airport's fault, though, for not having a better system?
I mean, it could be, but I think you still have this issue, right, of you're one of 100 people trying to get a cab with your phone out. It's a mess. That'll always be the case, I think. But with a taxi line, you don't have to worry about that aspect of it. So on the centralized aspect, I think the taxis have an advantage. But on the decentralized aspect, going to the airport from your home, I mean, the taxi companies just can't compete with Uber's infrastructure.
Oh.
In that sense, I think they're separate markets. But obviously, there's still 100 people at the airport waiting for an Uber or Lyft, right? So they are competing in that sense.
Okay. We're going to switch now to another facet of the sharing economy. That is short-term rentals. They're everywhere in this country. Nationwide, last year, they say it was a $63 billion industry. And in Las Vegas, which is driven by its tourist economy, they're in almost every neighborhood. The website AirDNA says demand is growing, prices are increasing, and revenue is expected to increase after it dropped nearly 5% in 2023. But the question in Nevada is, are they taking away from the state's bread and butter, the resort industry, or perhaps are they adding to it? Amanda Bellarmino is a professor in UNLV's College of Hospitality. Amanda, welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you back here. So what would you say the short-term rental industry, how would you say they've impacted the resort and hotel industry? We couldn't find statistics, direct statistics, saying they're taking away this percent of business. But anecdotally or from what you know, what is happening?
I would say, if anything, they're adding to it. What we see traditionally throughout the world when you look at Airbnb is that they serve underserved markets, just as you were speaking with Uber. especially when you're looking at families, people that are not well served by traditional hotels or by traditional hotel casinos. In Las Vegas, you know, it's a relatively small amount compared to the casinos. You know, there aren't as many. If you added up all the Airbnbs for rent, it's not going to add up to the size of one of the properties on the Strip. So we wouldn't even be talking about it if you had a 300-room hotel open. We wouldn't even care. I think the bigger impact we see here is more the impact. Is the perceived impact on housing prices. But we see that everywhere they go, you know.
You mean the potential downward impact on a housing price because of short-term rentals in the neighborhood?
I think what we see more is there's discussion about, is it artificially inflating the housing prices?
Oh, I see. Okay.
Because investors are purchasing the homes instead. But we see that in every market that Airbnb goes into. And I think one of the things is that, you know, during the recession, you had condos trying to attract people to rent it out as an Airbnb because they wanted to sell them. We wanted to have, you know, some sustainability in these places, and so that's why you had it. I don't see it as taking away from the hotel and resort market. If anything, you know, studies I have done indicate that people that come to stay in Airbnb are gaming, and they're going to the casinos to game. They're doing these things. They just have another reason to be there. And again, many of them are people that are relocating here. So I'm going to stay in an Airbnb until I'm able to find a place to live. That's not a person that you necessarily want in your casino hotel because they're trying to go to work and they're not going to be gambling and they're not going to want to be eating every meal at your restaurant. So it's serving an underserved population. It's not taking away from what we're seeing in our hotel and resorts. Other markets, you see a little bit of that, but I don't think that's an issue that we're going to see here. Another thing that we know when it comes to looking at Airbnb in Las Vegas, like I said, is it helps us when we have it's a stepping stone for these big events that we're now hosting for Super Bowl. You know, it didn't take away anybody's occupancy or rate, but it allowed us to have more people in town by having those Airbnbs available. And I think it can continue to do that for other events that we have, is that it gives us just that little bit more occupancy than we have. No. There's an Airbnb right behind me, and there were three people.
Behind your house.
Behind my house. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Behind my house. No big deal. And there were three people that stayed there during Super Bowl. And when I was talking to them, they are all Uber drivers that came to town to drive Uber from LA. And they had rented it as soon as the Super Bowl was announced in Las Vegas. But it's not, you know, it's not disruptive to the neighborhood. Okay. It's just you just see a little bit of that here and there. So I think that it's going to continue, but I don't foresee it having a major impact on our hotels.
Yeah, just about everybody I know, when they travel overseas or anywhere in this country, they're always looking for an Airbnb. At the same time, I'm reading more anecdotally about how the prices of Airbnbs are rising. But in this market specifically, is it cheaper to stay in a short-term rental than to stay in a hotel on the Strip?
Not cheaper, but it looks at what are you getting for the value. And I think that's what you're looking at. If you want a kitchen, if you want free parking, if you want multiple rooms, then yeah, it's going to equal out. But necessarily, is it cheaper? No.
So your assessment is this adds to the tourism economy.
Exactly.
That's right. You know, in Las Vegas, the city council recently fined an absentee short-term rental homeowner $180,000. I think that's being appealed. Clark County recently imposed a $17,000 fine against a homeowner for an illegal listing. At the same time, the county has a backlog of, about 700 applications since March of last year that they are trying to process. But I wonder if you think those kinds of issues are going to slow down the short-term rental industry. And maybe I'll ask this in a bit with another one of our guests. But if it scares people from even trying to get into that business, thinking about some of the fines that could be leveled against them if they aren't complying with the law.
I think it may. I think that it could have a negative impact. And you have to consider the reason a lot of people do this is because the inflation and the issues that you have with making money right now. You know, it is unfair to people that are trying to make a living to perhaps rent out that house that they inherited from their parents, or they've relocated and they don't necessarily want to take a loss on the house that they're selling, so they're trying to rent it out. So I think that the county should hopefully find a better way to work with homeowners to be able to do this.
Okay. And now with us is Pius Agu. He is a Las Vegas vacation short-term rental host, a property owner. He's also a member of the Greater Las Vegas Short-Term Rental Association. He owns 7 properties and has been doing this since 2016. Pius, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure's all mine.
So talk about why you got into the short-term rental business and how it's been for you lately.
I got into it in large part due to desperation. I experienced some financial issues. In the past, I was a student trying to pay my tuition. The job that I had at the time basically shut down. My last check bounced from the employer that I was being employed by, so I didn't have any other recourse to pay my rent for that month. And so out of desperation, luckily one of my roommates was moving out of the property in which I resided, mm-hmm. and I put his room up on Airbnb, just a single room, and I made $1,100 in 7 days. It more than covered the amount that I was short, and after that, the rest was history.
Wow. So you kept reinvesting and getting into the business a little bit deeper.
I saw it as a viable option. I did a cost analysis and I did like an extrapolation for larger homes because, you know, if I can achieve that with a small room, I just imagined what could be achieved with an entire home.
So what's business like today? I wonder if you're seeing a rise, a fall, or is it basically the same as years past? What's it like right now?
It's profitable, but it's treacherous.
How treacherous?
Well, we're currently at war, basically, with Clark County Code Enforcement. They are targeting short-term rental owners, property owners, basically, and issuing very hefty citations, trying to discourage people from this business model.
Not just that, but 2 years ago, again, the Clark County Commission approved an ordinance that was designed to cut the number of short-term rentals by 75%. Some people might not know this, but the city of Las Vegas doesn't oversee the Strip or most of the county. That is the county commission. After that, the commissioners were accused without evidence that they were doing the bidding of the resort industry. I wonder if you see a direct competition between the resort industry and their hotels and short-term rentals.
Well, naturally, anytime there's a disruptive business model, the people that are benefiting from that business before, they don't want things to change. So, I mean, but it's almost like stopping the current of a river. You know, the future is coming and there's nothing that can be done about it. The people that are wise will make the adjustment and get in front of it rather than try to prevent it from happening. It's going to happen.
Get in front of it and maybe join in and create their own. So what type of customer base do your short-term rentals usually attract?
All walks of life. I mean, with smaller listings, you have shared listings. So those are much more affordable. You know, maybe like a battered wife or someone that's trying to, not be in a violent situation. I've had a guest just come and stay with her kid because she had no other place to go, and that was the only place she could afford. I've had families that they had a son that is in the military at Nellis, and he couldn't get leave for Thanksgiving, so they decided, you know, they're retired. They decided to come and have Thanksgiving with him instead, mm-hmm. and they wanted to have a family Thanksgiving, basically. You get the convention industry is huge in Las Vegas. A lot of people come out here for CES and Evo and a lot of these other conventions that bring in thousands of people. Those people are not necessarily the type of individuals that you're going to see wanting to book a suite at the Bellagio. Mm-hmm. They want a kitchen. They want fast Wi-Fi. They want to be able to wash their clothes. There are certain amenities that they're looking for that the hotels simply just don't provide.
Yeah. Do you get many complaints from neighbors about the this was a huge issue 10 years ago, even as recently as 5 years ago, that people neighbors of short-term rentals were complaining about the noise that would come from some of the people who would stay in them. Do you get those kind of complaints, or are you very careful about that?
Of course, as a host myself, I make sure that I endear myself to my neighbors, make sure that I'm not doing anything to disrupt the neighborhood. My neighbors love me, and I think that the narrative about noise and disruptive events has been weaponized by the oligarchy that's trying to keep things the way that it is. And it's like the boogeyman, and there's really not much substance to it. Most hosts immediately shut down these type of events because, like I said, this is a treacherous industry. We're on the precipice of getting this thing legalized with restrictions. So why would we want to endanger that campaign?
We have about less than a minute left, but I want to ask you about this. You know, the county has said with their new ordinance, they'll permit about 2,800 properties. That means there are 11 to 12,000 out there that will not get permitted. In March of 2023, the county took applications and they drew 1,300 of those in a lottery. Do you think, as people accused commissioners, that they are limiting permits to help the resort industry?
I think that, to harken back to what I said previously, the narrative of disruption to neighborhoods and increased price gouging with property prices has been used to basically push these false narratives on the public, and there's no substance to them whatsoever.
And with that, I want to thank Pius Ego, short-term rental owner, member of the Greater Las Vegas Short-Term Rental Association, Andrew Gnadovich, former cab driver, currently a real estate agent, Mark Tremblay, professor of economics at UNLV, and Amanda Bellarmino, professor in UNLV's College of Hospitality.